best fellow in sports, if you made the team and was on the teams, of course, that took up for one of the hours that, from 3 to 4 that the other kids had to do in the classroom.
Yeah.
So we were fine because you get out there and maybe 45 minutes, maybe half an hour, and the coach would say, well, go, you need to do something with your studies, now go do it because this is your this is your hour to do it. Very seldom would you ever have to do that because we're usually the coaches. Number one, you know.
Fall must have been a little bit better for you because basketball is in the winter and baseball is in the spring. Do you have a little more free time in the fall?
Well, we did because we didn't have football.
Yeah.
In the little schools.
Yeah. Well, you were too small for playing football, right. Either, were you?
Well, no.
No.
When I was a senior, I weighed 145 pounds.
Yeah.
That's pretty good size. And anyway.
Sorry. Last time you said that was not much, I thought.
No, it was.
Not for football, anyway.
No. And just the 1 year, when I was a senior, why they decided to get the district, they was going to fit us on to football again. And I just got to play a couple of games and lost my appendix, knocked them out in the football game, and that was it. But so I don't know much about the football game, but I do know that a lot of guys love to try. And that's what I call it. You got to love to try to play sports. If you don't, you're not going to make it.
What are the main discouragements?
Encouragement.
Discouragements.
Oh, I suppose a lot of it would be your coach. Repetition. You know, just things that maybe he thinks is the only thing that should happen, and half your team thinks it should, and half of them thinks it shouldn't, and this type of thing, and it becomes a disgruntled operation. For a good coach, you don't have that. I would like to be a coach.
You would? Seriously, or just?
Yes, seriously.
Mm-hmm. You would have had to go back to college, you get other college
right.
Training after you got out of the Army or the Navy, wouldn't you?
Yes, I'd had that whole 4 years. And of course, by then I had a family.
Yeah, you think if you hadn't been married, you would have done that?
I'd probably tried.
What do you think would have been the satisfactions for you of coaching?
Kids.
It's kids.
Yeah. Yeah, sure would have been. You can tell a team is happy and good at it.
Yeah. Yeah. And what you said with the emphasis on character, discipline, it probably was a very important, well, it still is, a very important influence on young people's lives.
All their life.
Yes.
Influence all their life.
Could we move now to the time when you came back to the Grand Ronde Valley after you were discharged from the Navy and all that hospital experience you'd had. You said, I think, that your first work was with the Union Pacific.
It would have been. They wanted me to go to work for them. And I went over and I did take 3 trips with them on the whole Portland roads back in those days. You had to go to, you went from here to Portland,
yeah.
Deadhead, they called it. Then we went from there, you stayed right on the same train, because the passenger train, all the way to Omaha, Nebraska.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to ask you about that. If your responsibility would have been to fix the engine if it broke down somewhere?
If it was just something like, say, a fuel injector or something, this went out and it just wasn't up to power, you're supposed to be able to know that, in other words,
yes.
And diagnose it, and you could repair it if it wasn't to the place to where it was affecting the rest of the engines. You usually had one spare engine. Most people didn't know that, but lots of times it's engines. It's just like a ship. Ships, almost all ships, got one spare engine they never use unless something happens to one of the other engines. But on the Union Pacific, they were, since they were using them so much during the war, so often, so many hours, you just automatically checked everything all out, the fuel systems and all that, and made sure that it was running.
Did you do that every time it stopped on a run?
No. You had a regular routine, just like your car. Change the oil every 3,000 miles, so that's a lot of the same type of thing you'd use.
Well, I'm not understanding why you, a diesel engineer or diesel mechanic, would have had to be on the run of the Portland Rose. What were you expected to do on that trip?
Well, say that it's just routine, more or less. Say you get a bunch of dirty fuel or something like that, or just injector systems. That's the main thing where we had lots of problems with diesels to start with. They'd get plugged up and the diesel would just run on two or three cylinders. Well, on Portland Rose is an 8-cylinder job. That's what I specialized in the Navy. And if something could start missing right away, you knew it. You had all kinds of gauges and everything. But you could repair that, where if you got two engines doing that, you'd be out of business. Couldn't be out of business in the Portland Roads, you know, it had to run. And so you could have one off, or maybe injectors out of two, and that's what you was there for. You might travel that thing for 6 months and never touch a wrench.
That's what I wondered. You were there just as a safety precaution.
Absolutely.
So that if anything went wrong, yeah. If you were in the middle of North Dakota somewhere, you'd get out and fix it, huh?
Or well, you stayed in and fixed it. They were all made, see these, the reason those things are all covered on the outside, the engines are all inside.
Yeah.
And you have walk ramps and stuff like that. You can get to almost any part of a diesel engine on the inside of one of these to fix the type of thing that they would expect you to fix. No complete repairs on those engines at all. They pull them off and put them in a roundhouse.
When you said they always had a spare engine, you mean the whole locomotive, or?
No, that's a lot of times you're talking about the whole locomotive. Now, most of these locomotives has got 2 to 3 engines on in the inside.
Yes.
So if one of those went out, if they had 3 engines, the 2 would be fine. Well, then they'd go into the next town or whatever, and then they'd switch the locomotives out, the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
Take this engine out and put in another one, and he's ready to go the next trip.
Okay.
That's the way it works.
All right, I understand. Where exactly were you traveling when you'd go on the Portland Rose? Were you in sitting in the locomotive, or were you back in the passenger car, or where?
You had your own, all these people that worked there, just like the cooks and people like that, and the brakemen and everybody.
Yeah.
And you have your
crew
own
car?
Yeah, yes, you have your own car. Real nice places.
Sure.
But I had a family.
What were you?
That stopped.
Yeah. If you weren't really working most of the time when you were traveling on the Portland Rose, what did you do?
Play checkers.
So sleep a lot?
To be honest with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Played all kinds of cards.
You sleep a lot too?
Not too much. Yeah. You stayed in shape. If you didn't, boy, you'd get one like I got now.
Yeah.
You know.
What were you doing to stay in shape?
They had all kinds of stuff that you could work with. They even had dumbbells and some of these newer. But nowadays, they don't have to worry about that because they jump you off about every 12 hours and stick you on, and away you go back the other way. But the Portland Rose, we only had 3 of those whole things. Mm-hmm. So one at this end, one at that end, and one in the middle, you know. And so you had to have facilities for everybody to. But nowadays, I don't think most of these guys, just on what they call. They have some fellow that'll call it up, and he can get on it right here in Le Grand. Go ahead.
Did you have any really memorable experiences while you were doing that kind of work?
No. Like I say, I was not long enough. I only made 3 trips. Shakedown crew, they called them. And my message said, hey, you didn't marry me to run up down a railroad track. So I said, okay.
You weren't on long enough to get a retirement
didn't
benefit
really,
from the railroad.
Didn't get paid.
Yeah.
Didn't even get paid.
Didn't get get paid.
That's the reason they call it a shakedown.
I see. So after you decided that wasn't for you, that's when you found the Caterpillar company, that they needed somebody?
Well, they found me, more or less. I was supposed to work for 6 months to a year after I got out of the service. I was on full sick leave and all that type of thing. And they would allow me to work 4 hours a day after I was out about 5-6 months. And so the first job I got was with Montgomery Ward. I was down there, I had a great uncle that worked in Montgomery Ward and had a big store here then.
The one in LeGrand, yes.
Yeah. And he kept saying, come on down, or we need somebody to help us inventory in the basement. Well, they had regular hardware stores back in those days. And I finally said, okay, I'll come down, Uncle, and help you a little bit. And the word was out that I was, I guess you'd say, back home. And so a fella walked in one morning to the basement where I was inventorying a bunch of bolts. Oh, forget that. Are you Orville Trump? And I said, yes. And he said, how would you like to go to work for Caterpillar Tractor Company? Just, that's it. So I just walked across town, went over, walked into another building, went to work.
What was the nature of the first work you did with them?
Well, the first work I did with them was the Navy man that was in charge of my health benefits at that time. In and told them exactly what they could do, what they couldn't do. Keep doing the job. I couldn't work for 4 hours a day, and I couldn't do this, I couldn't lift over 20 pounds, and I couldn't do this, and I couldn't do that. And they said, we'll take care of that. Don't worry about it. So believe it or not, the first job I had was steam cleaning parts. Here I am, these engineers have steam cleaning parts. But anyway, I went all the way up through them that way, and finally did get hurt. They told me I would, and I did. And after a couple of years of that, I believe, maybe 18 months, transferred me over into the parts department in the dealership here. And golly, pretty quick, I was feeling really good. The more I moved around and worked, the better I felt. And so the first thing you know, I was working full time. Well, the Navy said, well, hey, if you go to work full time, you're not going to get much of a pension, fella. You know, so they cut the heck out of my pension. And I said, okay, I was young. Like they said, that vinegar deal, I had lots of that going. And so that's where I went from then on out. And then I stayed there about 2 or 3 years. And
what exactly did you do in the parts department? I think I can imagine, but tell me.
Well, in a parts department, you do about everything. Number one, everybody thinks, well, you just stand there behind the counter and wait till some guy comes in. And,
yeah.
But it doesn't work that way, because all at once you've got a great big shipment in a railroad car or a big truck or something comes in the back door, and that's got to be put into inventory stock. So you spend 2 or 3 people doing nothing in a big deal like that, but just putting away stock. And the way you did that, of course, when it came in, it had a part number on it and a location, so you could just take it out of a big crate and break it down and put it away. But we've had fellows who worked there 4 or 5 years and never do anything but that. And then when you'd sell that item, like you'd sell it over into Burns country to a big logger, that he'd give you a big order, and then this fellow would turn around and package it all up and send it to Burns, and this is what they would do. But I didn't go for that kind of stuff. I had to have something better, so they finally just out of the blue sky, they wanted to know if I wanted to move up the bars. So then I was about 6 or 8 months there doing nothing but inventory on cards, checking
that. Oh, you kept
cards? Oh, yes.
Handwritten cards?
Yes. You checked them in and checked it out.
Did you keep those in alphabetical order?
Oh, absolutely.
Or was it by part number?
It was part number. Mm-hmm. You had to know what your parts were and the location. Mm-hmm. It had to be on the same. It was very simple. And then after you're there for a while, so you knew the system, then they'd start letting you wait on customers. And it's a regular training. Take you about 3 years to really get through the training system. But they had a good one then. But now I don't know what they do. We would, just luckily, I was there, I guess, about 2 years, and we expanded early at that time, and they bought out the old dealer that was here, and they also the John Deere dealership that was here, and combined the two and changed the name. And then we started moving stores, and put a store in John Day, and put a store in Enterprise. And of course, the people that was working there with experience, we, if they wanted to, we'd give them a chance to move into a better job at the other store. So that's the way that works, just like any business. And it is, in fact, it is a big business, about yeah. one of the third big businesses in the United States.
When we talked about this last time, you mentioned several different sizes of diesel engines.
Right.
I wasn't clear, though, exactly what the equipment that these engines were for. Combines, for example, threshing machines, tractors, bulldozers. Is that like all those kinds of things?
Well, usually, as far as the diesels themselves is concerned, back in the days when I worked on them, of course, the main part of these tractors was started way back before World War I, to World War II. In that area, they were mostly all gas engines. And they had a case. It wasn't Caterpillar, it wasn't case. It was two different names of people down in California, one in Chicago and one in California, that was building these tractors just piece by piece in their garages, in their backyard. And when World War I came along, they said, well, we think we can make a tractor that'll go in the mud. And that's where the old Caterpillar came in. They got themselves together and formed one dealership and changed the name of it to Caterpillar. So it's this same old tractor with the tracks on it, always very, very many, many times changed in design and power and so forth. But the diesel engine itself is the same type of thing, except back then it was gasoline. And then it came on and they just diverted it over to diesel. And same way your motor graders. See, what they have is a great big mammoth plant that makes nothing but engines. And they make everything from a little old engine, just a little bit bigger for a riding lawnmower, diesel, all the way up to the biggest machine that runs today. And they build them to fit into the other type of thing. In other words, if they're working on a big dam or something and needs one of these big shovels that you see working all day, it's got a Caterpillar engine in the middle of it that's doing all the driving and gearing and everything, and that's what they're for. And many, many, many of your boats that you see out here are Caterpillar.
So the work you were doing at the Caterpillar place in Le Grand only involved engines?
No. We were a dealer for Caterpillar.
So the machines, the engine fitted in, you were selling?
Yes.
And therefore you stocked all the parts for this machine?
All the parts from the radiator to the tailgate.
Okay.
Of everything they have, all their driving parts and everything.
But am I correct in thinking that you also did repairs?
Absolutely.
Yes. They wouldn't bring the machine into town to repair it, would they?
If possible. We had big trucks. And anything we could load on, you see them driving up and down the road.
Yeah. Sometimes when you go out.
A lot of those will be coming in to, because you can't repair a lot of that big stuff in the field. You've got to have it in where they've got big cranes and stuff like that.
But you yourself weren't actually doing the repairs, is that right?
I was for some time until I got hurt there. And then I transferred into the parts department.
I see.
And then from the parts department, after I'd been there for some little time, they started expanding, like I said, in other towns, and that left an opening in their main store for parts managers and service managers. So they said, well, we're not that big, you can do both. You know, so they made a parts and service manager out of me. So then I went into management. We had our own training programs. I took care of our own training and everything, teaching mechanics how to overhaul these engines and all that type of thing. So I spent a lot of time away from home, but I liked the job real well.
In order to learn how to manage training programs, did you have to go take training somewhere yourself?
Absolutely. Peoria, Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was that similar in any way to the training you had at Iowa State?
No. Well, it would be if you just completely disassembling, like I'm training on my people. If there's a group large enough, we would take an old engine and tear it all to pieces. Yeah. And then we'd say, okay, guys, let's make a run, you know. And that's the type of thing we had back then. Yeah. It's still in use right now, I'm sure. But with computers, well, you don't have to worry about that too much. Just stick a little old electric cord in the hole and say, this is what you're throwing. It's altogether different. And I could show you a picture of a Caterpillar back in the before World War II and show you one that they're selling at the store right down here, and you would never know that they were the same piece of machinery, but they are.
You must have had a lot of conversations with the owners of these machines.
Yes. I used to say, well, you know, this is a really thankful job that I have here, because any time that a owner calls me up, it's usually after hours and the stores are all locked up and he's got my home phone number and he's mad. He broke down, he's mad, he can't get any parts, the store's not open. So 80% of the time, if you're a manager, especially a service manager, it's something like that. That's when he's down, boy, he's got millions of dollars in these road jobs, you know. And usually I could treat him right, but I enjoyed it. His competition against mine, you know.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed that type of thing. Most people didn't. They wouldn't have it. I've hired a lot of guys. In 6 months, they throw up their heads and say, I just can't take that kind of crap. How do you do it? Well, I didn't have to do it. I knew how the guy worked. You got to know your people.
Right.
And you got to know your customers. That's the secret.
You were usually able to provide the repair service that they need?
Well, maybe not, but I could get him around to where within a few hours or a few days or something we would work it out. And maybe we'd have to give him a used machine or something, haul it to him and haul his in. But you could work it out.
When you say the job was thankful, I guess you mean that you were usually able to figure out how to solve the problem and they were very grateful to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I would be satisfied.
You bet.
Sure.
You bet.
Sure. Especially when you knew that a lot of money was at stake, usually.
Yeah. Yeah, you can see $1 million a day going down the trade. Don't you? I got to help this guy.
Last time when we talked, I asked you about, or we discussed a little bit, unions. And I had the impression that you don't think much of unions.
I didn't in those days. And I always said the union had its place and it should have been used, but they weren't used right. They let the convicts and all those kinds of people, a bunch of these Italians running by guns and this type of thing, get in charge of all of them. So it got to the place to where if you didn't belong to the union and you took your pickup that had your signs on it or didn't even have them on it and drive out on a construction job that these guys were controlling with the union, they'd block you off of there and you couldn't even hardly get your pickups back off the job.
Strong arm.
Strong arm Pete's boy all the way. And I strong armed it the other way just as bad as they did me. But
did you get into any fights?
No. No, you didn't have to. There's always a reason and a cause. And usually if what it ends up, most everything was the fact that this tractor, for some reason, had warranties on it yet. But the union wasn't allowed to touch. The factory's the only ones that could work on warranties. So if you just sit down and talk to these guys a little bit, it's always a tail-end guy that you just hired 3 weeks ago that wants to make a name for himself and is getting us all in trouble. It can always be worked out, you know. I spent 30-some years of that.
You had pretty direct observation that the unions were controlled by gangster types?
Absolutely. I don't care if
even in Union County?
I don't care what they say anytime. Well, Union County was so small, the county didn't even belong to Union back in those days. It was just the big outfits upon the unions.
Mm-hmm. But there weren't any attempts to bring unions into Union County?
Oh, every day. There'd be union guys in my shop. I'd have to run them out darn near once a week.
What would they do and what would they say?
I'd just try to convince them how much better the pay was and how much better the big contract their pensions were and all this kind of stuff. And usually they did offer more money. And they'd offer you top pay in 3 years. Well, nationally, Caterpillar had a 4-year training program. But the unions were paying top wages in 3 years. They get your man away from him and find out if he isn't qualified for a lot of things, and then they can keep him 6 months or so, and he wasn't qualified. They didn't care about that. They just wanted to get him away from you. But nowadays, it's different than that. It's changed a lot.
When the union organizers would come in to Union County, would they try to talk to the workers during work hours?
They would if they could. I usually had people stopping that.
How did you do that?
Well, through a lot of confidential things to different people, different people.
Did you know who the organizers were? Did they ever talk to you?
Oh, yeah. They try to run you off the job. Even when you're driving around in your big automobile and the mechanics are all in their pickups, so they know who you are the minute you hit that place.
But were your main dealings with the union organizers when you were a manager?
Well, yes and no. Most unions are real sensible. And now the unions are down to where they're into small places like the county here. Maybe the city's probably even got the unionizers and that type of thing. And they've got it pretty well balanced out now to where the unions finally woke up to the fact that, hey, we can't live with these guys that carries the rifles. We got to learn how to get along with our customers. And so it's completely changed. It isn't like it used to be. Thank God.
Well, of course, what I'm interested in here is trying to get as much understanding of how it used to be.
Well,
as I can.
A lot of it was probably in my own head. In other words, but I could usually make my main people, my managers and so forth, pretty well see what I'm trying to do to keep my mechanics, giving them a decent wage. Usually if I'd find out that there's going to have a big vote or something, like you hear the schools and all this stuff going on, if I know it's going to happen, why, sooner or later I just tell them, now look, we're not going to join this thing and I'm not going to give you guys a big pay raise and then can all of you 6 months from now. If you want a nice living wage and you want a good retirement, this is the place to be. But if I found out, and he wasn't allowed, see, he can one of them if he'd been talking to a union man. That's against the law. And
it's called union busting.
Yeah. And so you just have a public meeting and tell them, hey, now I'm giving you guys a decent way to tell them what they're getting, not what they're going to get. And the unions tell them what they're going to get. And then I can say something, well, I remember Lawrence Fox, he worked here for 4 years. Where's he working now? Run the bulldozer down the county. I wouldn't hire him back. Do the same thing and get somebody else to help.
But you were usually successful in persuading them not to join the union?
Never had one of my outfits join the union.
When you were doing that kind of work, were the retirement benefits that your workers were getting or would get?
Sometimes they had, and it came in after World War II and so forth, and things got to be a little better and organized. They start to have hospitalization and things like that, which would help the families. Mm-hmm. And this was pretty easy to sell, because if you had a pretty good-sized family and something happened in the family that several of them was laid up at the same time, boy, they were in trouble. There's just a lot of things that you could talk to people about without breaking the union, you know, or saying that you're breaking the union. I haven't been in actual open court about it, but I have been accused of a lot of it, but never proven that I ever had any, because I really didn't. I wasn't that kind of a badger.
If somebody who didn't have health insurance had a serious injury, accident, would the company help the family in some way, or did you rely on charitable organizations in the community, like Elks, maybe?
No, I really can't answer that. I think every company and everybody, even the car dealers, would have their own ways to help out if they could. The employees donate a little money here or there.
But they would do that regularly for somebody who was really in trouble?
Usually, yes. Yeah. We kind of pride ourselves of having the type of people working for us that they cared about their other employees.
They had loyalty.
Right. Yes. Absolutely. That's well worth preaching.
Mm-hmm. What were attitudes, at least that you are aware of, about Social Security deductions?
Well, I just took it as something that had happened and it looked like to be. And they explained it years and years ago. And when I was 16 years old, I took Social Security, because they didn't tell you that it was a retirement. They didn't say it was going to completely save the whole universe from going broke, you know. They said, here, for so many dollars a month, you can get this much when you retire, if you ever retire, and a lot of faults in it, but as long as you thought you was going to get something, because you wasn't getting anything back in those days. Well, I think everybody probably fell pretty well in line with it. It's just been the late instigators that's given us the trouble. Too many rich men, and I shouldn't say that again.
But you think the common attitude was Social Security is a really good thing?
Yes.
And they didn't resent the deductions?
No, they didn't. They could see it every year. We had it, deductions every month on their paychecks. And they knew exactly what. They knew exactly if you're going to quit tomorrow, you don't get it. That's the thing you got to preach. If you don't use it, lose it.
What vacation allowances did people get in those times?
It was just pretty well. We had one after you was there for 1 year, you'd get 1 week's vacation. But then you had to work 3 years to get 2 weeks vacation. But that was an insanity to get to start to work in the first place, because most of them had been out of work and they just needed anything that they could get. That extra week made an awful lot of difference, because a lot of them go out there and work in a hayfield or some doggone thing and make a few extra bucks, and along with that week's vacation. And boy, that made Christmas for me. Yeah.
It's So people really mostly didn't take vacations.
Well, for a long time we had it that if you wanted to work it, we'd pay you for the vacation time.
Oh.
In other words, if say you worked this week and we needed you to work next week, but we'll give you the vacation for it, that's just like double time and a half.
And did a lot of people take you up on that?
Not a lot.
But you
we
said...
We preached the thing that, hey, you've been working 50 hours, 12 months out of the year, and you've got 4 weeks here that qualifies for something. We don't think that that should be something that you feel that you just have to take. But we want you to take it because we think that in that length of time, you certainly need it. Not only for the company you're working for and yourself, but for your family. And that's the way we sold that.
Did most people take all their vacation time in one period, consecutively?
Usually not.
Several different times
during the year? In this area, they didn't, because I always liked the oil company. You know?
Yeah.
That, in other words, one of my employees said this. Hey, boss, put me up on the board for November the 1st through the 12th, and then I'll take the other 2 days of Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
We do that.
What do you remember about people going on trips for their vacations?
I remember that I was one of the ringleaders. My wife was from South Dakota and Iowa, so that just put 2 to 3 weeks every year. Got to go home.
Did you drive there?
Yep. Almost always. Either that or I'd send the wife, when the kids were little, I'd send the wife home on the train. We'd get a roomette, something for the kids to enjoy, get a couple of days, and then she'd stay there maybe 30 days, and I'd go back and pick them up and bring them home. Go through the Black Hills and stuff like that. We used to go home every 2 years. That took a lot of vacation. It'd take 2 days to go back there. I think we've been to all of about 4 states.
Most people didn't have RVs or boats or any of those kinds of equipment.
They still can't afford. They still haven't figured this out. How they can afford to do that when you can get a real nice motel room for $75 for your whole family, you
yes.
know. And you could eat out for $20 a day. How can you afford a $45,000 motorhome?
I've never understood it either. The attitude, I think, 50 years ago was that expensive vacation wasn't really something you needed to think about.
That's true. We didn't. We used to feel that, you know, we start putting $100 here in a can and $100 there in a can, and $400 or $500, and we'd be good for 2 or 3 weeks on a nice vacation. And we didn't miss it. Nowadays, you got to have a $50,000 motorhome to enjoy it.
I know what a lot of people do. You mentioned Christmas. How did your family, both when you were younger and when you had your own wife and children, usually celebrate Christmas?
The old way, the old-fashioned way, just like Grandpa and Grandma did.
Tell me about it.
Well, we were quite a family. I had, I think I said before in the other one, I had 3 brothers, myself, and then 2 sisters. We always had the grandma seem like around someplace, pretty close-knit family within the family. But then once when they grew up like you're talking about and started having their own families, then that started doubling and tripling the pressure on Grandpa and Grandma, you know, for Christmas. And it did make a difference, definitely made a difference, but we still had the same old Christmas dreams and still old the taffy and popcorn and all.
Did you go out and cut the Christmas tree?
Absolutely.
Where?
wherever the government let me.
how did you decorate it?
I have some of the, and I don't know what the kids did with them, because since it's been like it is, I lost everything I had. I mean, they just sold everything and given away or kept it for themselves. And I haven't been able to find out what went where, but I've had a whole slug of Christmas ornaments between World War I and World War II. I still use it. Still use the old green Christmas trees. Finally did start putting lights on.
Did you ever use candles on trees?
No. Absolutely not.
Were these ornaments that you made, or the other members of the family made?
Some of them on the hill were. Some of them are things that got from overseas, such as China, Hong Kong, places like that. And they look just like the ones that we got today.
Yeah. How did you handle gifts?
We drew names, usually.
Each person get one thing?
So much money. After all, Christmas is not a time to spend a lot of dough for friends. Give each other a nice gift. The rest of it to the Lord.
What sorts of gifts do people usually give?
Oh, after we got to be my age, for instance, it usually ended up being clothes.
Yeah.
Or maybe a watch.
As you were a teenager, what would have been the gift?
Probably just anything that the folks could actually come up with, more or less. I think the gift that I wasn't a teenager, but I was the gift I first remember ever receiving, and I still have it, is a little teeny mother dog and three little porcelain dogs, little puppies. I've still got them, just like they're brand new.
Why did they mean so much to you?
First real gift I ever could remember receiving.
Who gave them to you?
My folks. It was Santa Claus, of course.
And they didn't get broken all this time.
You bet they didn't. I've got a new glass.
That's good.
And I got the first set of marbles from a teacher when I was in second grade in school, in an old country school.
The teacher gave them to you?
And I was the only one in the first grade in the school. This particular winter was a terrible, terrible winter. They had to ride horses or skis or something to school. I didn't miss one grade. My older brother carried me to school. I still got the marbles. She gave me a little bag of marbles. Still got them in the second grade of school.
Have you played marbles a lot?
Oh, used to. Not with those.
No, those
that you played with.
They're too special, huh?
You bet.
When you played marbles, did you have steelies often?
Oh, golly. Especially up in high school, you know, you tried to figure out the biggest steelie you could get. Well, this logger friend that I said more or less halfway raised me during school year, he just lived three or four blocks apart. And he'd open up his shops and we'd start looking for big ball bearings. those old cats and trucks. Man, I remember they barred us at school from playing with the things, because we'd go out there and his old mechanics would cut those big old bearings up and we'd take the balls out. Because I had one time about almost 3/8 of an inch around, took it over to school and you could hit the middle of that pile of bearings. Marbles and poom, and they were all gone, you know. The school came into it. Said, well, I think we better bar these steelies. Played lots of marbles.
When you were in your, let's say, between 8 or 10 and 16 or 17, I imagine you listened to the radio every once in a while.
Not too much.
No time?
Well, sports was a lot of it. Mm-hmm. But then the fact that he was lucky if you had one radio in the house. Mm-hmm. My dad was a hard worker.
And he didn't buy a radio?
Yeah. and he bought a real, real good radio.
Oh, he did?
And he also sat right in front of it. So if you wanted to listen to something, you'd better listen to Amos and Andy or Little Annie Rooney. That's fine, as long as he would listen to it with you. But if he wanted his programs, you better go do your speed work. He wasn't rough that way. That was his way of teaching you to do your work. You know?
Well, do you listen? Do you remember listening to music?
Oh yes.
What was the source of live music or recorded music?
Well, very, very little. The only live music we had back in that country, the old people that came west, there's always a bunch of them in those wagon trains that could play almost any kind of an instrument,
Banjos and harmonicas, guitars.
Some of the people came out when my folks came out. I had one end up being my uncle. Had a 7-piece Western outfit. Brought the whole thing out here. Gonna be get rich farming playing Western music.
You mean he played all 7 pieces
himself? His family did.
Oh, I see.
From his wife right on down to the child. And boy, could they ever make music. They played music all over Willow County and made a good living out of it. You didn't have to farm.
What places would you go to listen to it?
Well, us kids, of course, you'd have to go to somebody's house, but usually on a Saturday night, they'd go play, they'd have a big dinner on Saturday night, a bunch of Saturday afternoons, and have music to play, and then in the evening, they'd go do everybody's chores, come back by about 8 or 8:30, us kids would all be there at that one farm. Ladies are cooking up a big meal. When they get that done, they'd come play music till about 11 o'clock and then start playing cards. Play cards all night long. Just change your clothes and go to church the next day.
And sleep after that.
Us kids just put us behind a bunch of chairs laying down with a bunch of blankets against the wall. That's where we stayed all night.
Can you remember any of the tunes they played, the names of them?
Red Wing was one. You probably didn't know Red Wing yet.
Yeah, I think you've heard it, yes.
Yeah. And Letter Edged in Black. Did you hear that?
No.
It's about a guy that's in jail for a long, long time, and he came home and thought he was going to, wrote a letter and said he was coming home or something, got out of jail, and folks were dead, or his dad was dead when he got there, and it's a letter edged in black. I don't know how it went. Anyway, that's the gist of it. There's a lot of them. I got a lot of them yet. I like Western music.
Who paid these musicians for their performances when they come to town?
Well, usually Grange Hall, if they have a Grange, is good to have like that. Or Enterprise, when they have Enterprise Days or something, all the people get together who's in business and donate $5 a piece or something. Either that or a jug of booze.
Well, did the people who came to listen have to pay admission?
Usually not. It was the day for the town, and they did do a lot of good shopping. That's when the people came to town. Maybe the only time they ever came to town.
Were some of the performers that you heard at the Elgin Opera House?
Oh, I'm sure there are.
Did you go to performances at the Elgin Opera House as well as Stack the Wood?
Oh yeah, the Opera House would give us a dime a cord of wood, and then the mill, they would pay us 25, 30 cents a cord besides, so we made pretty good money. Usually we take it out in tickets. And the ticket then was just 10 cents. So, gosh, we'd get enough tickets to go to every show in town, in the Opera House all winter long. But our folks wouldn't let us. But we could have, because they'd pay us off in tickets, or they'd pay us off a dime at a time.
Can you remember any of the shows you saw?
No. I don't know as I can. I probably could if I didn't have this blister on my head.
Were they usually music, or were they plays?
A lot of them are plays. And a lot of them are, I don't say local plays, but they'd be plays like come in there from the Grand, maybe Pendleton or Walla Walla. I remember that. They'd just travel around, and that was mostly for their enjoyment, same as Little Town enjoyment.
Yeah. Did you meet any of the performers?
Oh yeah, I remember being a bunch of dumb kids. We thought we had to know everybody, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Never didn't know anybody that was really, really good performer. In other words, nobody from Hollywood.
No stars.
Nobody from.
But what were the attitudes that people had about the Elgin Opera House and the entertainments that came there? Did they think that that was something really good, something special, unusual?
Golly. You couldn't even get up and down Main Street the whole day usually before somebody's coming there. Try to buy tickets or any old thing to get in to see them. It's something just didn't happen every day.
So it was really special.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that Opera House is special.
Yeah, it is. Have you been over there recently?
I went over and told them what to do with the deal on the, I'd say roof, but I mean the upper overhead. That stuff is all metal, you know, and it's old daub gray. I remember when they painted that thing, it was a beautiful metal color, and they painted the doggone thing in old daub gray paint. It looked like an old army job. And they was trying to figure out what to do with some of that thing, and I happened to have a little chunk of that metal. And I still had the thing. And I took it over and I said, "Fellow, this is what it looks like." And it was about 4x6. And I don't know whether they ever changed the ceiling back to the colors that it was or not.
Now, is this the ceiling of the main auditorium?
Yeah. It's got that plate and stuff.
Isn't that pressed metal with designs in it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they painted it, see, some dumb outfit. I don't know whether they ever come back or not. It'd be quite a job, you know.
I was in there this past week, and I didn't look back.
Yeah.
How did people get word about the performances that were coming up?
Well, they'd have, as long as I can remember, we had a weekly paper.
The Elgin Recorder?
Right.
And
one of my best friends' dad owned that.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was that? Who was that?
Tucker. His name is Tucker. Turley Tucker.
Turley Tucker. Hmm. And did you, was that delivered to your house?
No, they didn't deliver that. That came through the mail.
Really?
Even back then.
Did you read it?
I delivered the Observer. When I was a little guy.
Yeah.
When I was a little guy. I did anything you couldn't make it.
I guess you did. Did you read the Observer and the Recorder regularly?
I can never remember ever doing it. I was pretty young back then.
Well, you must have been a teenager, though, when the Recorder was
available. Yeah, but you just don't read that old folks' paper. You know?
Did you get magazines at your house, like the Saturday Evening Post or Country Gentleman?
No. No, we were old poor people.
Poor.
Say, you bet. That's the reason I guess I'd do anything I could to help.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember restaurants or a restaurant in Elgin?
Yes. I remember two restaurants. Three restaurants, four restaurants. One restaurant that was there for many, many years. My mother was a nurse. And
a nurse?
Mm-hmm.
How did she, you hadn't mentioned that, how did she become a nurse?
Well, we say a nurse. She was a licensed practical nurse.
Oh, yes. LPN.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they call them nurses back then.
Sure.
But sure.
Well, they were nurses.
And didn't have a full-time job, of course, sometimes, and after our kids all got school, high school away, she thought she had to help. And that's what the little old lady 5 foot was. And she was a cook, boy, I tell you. She do have a cook. Went to work in a restaurant. Colonel Hutt. Brother, I believe that. Vern Hutt had the restaurant.
What was it called?
I believe Hutt's Restaurant.
Hutt's Restaurant.
And
right on the main street?
Yeah, right on the main street.
Uh-huh.
And right beside it, that's the one they set a pot set on fire here a few years back and killed the old guy upstairs in the hotel. And that was don't know the name of it, but there 100 years. About somebody set it on fire and burned up an old guy upstairs. Mm-hmm. And then right beside it, believe it or not, was a beer joint. And it had a little restaurant, and that belonged to Vern Hutt. Then across the street, about right next to where the clothing store was, I think it's closed now, kids' clothing store, was upstairs in the dance hall, downstairs the big beer joint and the restaurant, and a pool hall behind, centralized spot in town. That's the main ones, the main restaurants. They're all right there to walk. Three of them lined up right side by side.
And did you eat there sometimes?
Oh, yes. When Mom went to work there a lot of times, right, they'd tell her, send your kids in here and let's give them something to eat, you know. But she wouldn't have to go home and cook.
Was this meat, potatoes, vegetable kind of dinner?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You bet. The old Western type dinners. They had all the business in town before it over. And she finally quit because she said, I can't handle this. She was doing the cooking and there's three people helping her and they still couldn't. It's open from about 4 o'clock in the morning to 11 or 12 every night. And she just finally said, hey, I can't do this. She was there several years. But back in those days, you didn't talk about what your folks did or where they worked or anything. You know, us kids didn't think anything about
it. Why?
No, I just didn't think about it. Mom works down at the cafe, you know. You have to break on her cooking. We do what she can cook.
Yeah. How many children did you say there were in your family?
There's 4 of us boys and 2 girls. And then Grandma was with us quite a bit.
And your mother's mother?
Mother.
Mm-hmm. You said she was a Santa?
Santa, right.
Have you had family reunions?
We used to have a Trump reunion all the time. And it just got to where, like myself and everybody, I don't have one, but everybody ended up one of those machines we're talking about, dragging around over the country, trailers and broken motor homes and all that kind of stuff. And used to go to Promise and have our reunions. And then they scattered out so far, like over around Olympia and Seattle and Bellingham and every place that just couldn't come over the weekend. And so then we started having our family reunion over at Hat Rock Park, over at Hermiston, on the Fundy River. And it was just a 2-day deal, and the first 3 or 4 years it turned out real good, 200 or 300 people. And then all at once the next year it went kapoof, and then it went about 35 or 40. So they wrote everybody a letter and said they're going to discontinue. They're just too busy.
Last week I was traveling around the north part of the county with Lyle and Elma Sanderson. You know who they are?
Yep. Yeah.
And we stopped at the Somerville Cemetery, and I saw where Lyle was going to be buried. I saw his name there, and I also saw yours.
Yep.
How did you decide
stuck
on...
Stuck her right in the middle, boy.
How did you decide on Somerville?
Family.
My folks other members of the family?
My folks there. Are buried there. I have a brother buried there. My wife is there.
So it's really going home.
Just a lot of us. Yep.
It's a wonderful cemetery.
Isn't it, though?
One of the best I've seen.
One of the oldest ones.
Yeah.
And I just, the way I got that one, I'd been trying for about 10 years to get plot, because I wanted a plot for my folks, my family. They didn't have any room.
Mm-hmm.
No room, no room, no room. So, finally said, well, we want to buy 2 acres. Well, while they're messing around here, the old guy that owned the 2 acres that we wanted to buy died. And his grandson got the farm. And the kid said, there's a pie piece right on the north end of that property I'll give you. But you can't have the 2 acres. Well, we said, why not? He said, well, he passed away with ours. Well, that kid said, don't you know we don't have handshakes anymore? That's what he said. What do you guess happened? So they took the pie. And I said, well, I'm near the center of that pie.
Yeah.
Kid, that's where I am.
Uh-huh.
Right there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, Lyle Sanderson says that he has left in his will a chunk of money to buy some land at the other side, the south side of the Somerville Cemetery, to expand it that direction.
Well, that'd have to be across the road.
Well, you know, when you come in from the south end, you come in one way and
right,
out the
right.
other, it's just